After Shaw.
He'll want to ask you a lot of questions too. And again, I will, and Chris with a K, I will remind you at the end of our interview, if I am forgetting something that you feel is important, you step in, because it's going to be the two of you for the rest of the show. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. I'll see you guys in about 2 or 3 minutes. And Chris Milligan, I don't know if you've seen it. Well, you haven't seen it. The video of the opening is unbelievable. But you'll love the audio. You'll being a musician, you will love the audio. But the video, when you see it in the show, is a brief compilation of film clips of all the great shows that I was in. And then on the Tonight Show, when I was on with Sinatra, Sinatra's on camera introducing me, and then I come out through the curtain, and there's a huge explosion of light. But it's fabulous. Anyway, you'll love that. And just rest for a couple of minutes, and I guess we're going to start. Tell us when we're going to start, Don.
Okay, well, we're going to start in exactly 2 minutes from Mark.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, you guys.
And can you hear me all right? Am I coming through fine?
Yes, Jack, you're coming through fine.
that's good. Thank you.
After you talk for a while, I'm going to bring that up, because everybody listening to you is going to say, my God, he sounds like John Kennedy. So, and I have commented, and you've heard it.
It's a provincial.
He's living in Vancouver now. Hey, have you ever heard of Len Osanek, Black Op Radio? Christopher.
The Black Op Radio sounds familiar, but
God. Let's do his show. Len Osanek is by far the best researcher and broadcaster about anything related to the assassination.
60 seconds.
Last year, he told me a guy came in who collect antique watches and asked him if it was possible to run a forensics test on an antique watch. The guy was a musician, a drummer, because Len Osanek has recording studios and records these big bands. I'm not going to mention that during our interview, but he was astounded, because now we come out with your unbelievable book. Anyway, stand by. We're going to start in a minute.
30 seconds.
How did the other interviews go today?
Are we talking?
Talking to you.
I have interviews later this evening. Nothing this come prior.
Oh, okay. I thought you did a Zoom interview earlier. You're on with Lorian Fenton at 8 o'clock. You'll do well with Lori. She's terrific. So,
all right, we're about ready to start your intro.
Okay, get
right there. Now, have a great show. Just come in when it's done.
The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My son. One shines so sincere, sunny one so true. I love you.
Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita singing Sonny, and of course, Frank Sinatra saying, here's Johnny, the night he hosted The Tonight Show. This is John Barber's World Live from Las Vegas, Nevada, 5 p.m. Pacific time. In a very, very important, to me, probably the best, most important show I've ever done. Long delayed. Tonight, it is being audio taped only. It's going out audio live, but we're videotaping it for later upload to YouTube and to the archives. And the reason for that is a technical problem. And the technical problem began a month ago. We had originally scheduled Chris Milligan, the publisher of Trine Day, and his author, Christopher Fulton, author of what I think is one of the best, most intelligent, most informative books ever about the assassination of John Kennedy. It's called The Inheritance. And I would rank it right up there with Jim Garrison's On the Trail of the Assassins and Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment. And believe me, I have them all. And it comes closest to Jim Garrison's story because aside from the enormous information that is entirely new contained in this impressive book, there's a deeply profound personal price paid for that. Unfortunately, 6 weeks ago, we were not able to do this because of a tragedy. And the tragedy is this. Our show is presented on BBS Radio. The home for BBS Radio. BBS Radio was built from scratch to one of the leading platforms in America. Just signed a massive contract with the United States government. They were so impressed with it. Built by twins, Don and Doug Newsom. Their home and their platform and their office was in Paradise, California. It burned to the ground. They lost absolutely everything. How anyone could survive that and come back is total beyond me. But with more than little help from my friends, more than a lot of help from their friends, and more than a lot of help from a lot of you who believe in free speech and alternative media, in 30 days, they have relocated, they have jerry-rigged BBS Radio and started all over again. And the profound thing about this and the most moving thing to me that was that Don and Doug lost their first home and business in the year 2010. They lost it to a flood. Last year, they lost everything. Paradise to a fire. And when I contacted them and we started to do this show and they wanted this to be the first show that was going to be streamed live with video, which we can't do, as you can understand, because of technical difficulties with their jerry-rigging, I asked them, where are you living now safely and warmly? And where are you broadcasting from? And he said, near San Francisco, California. Well, I couldn't help blurting out, oh my God, next you're going to be hit by an earthquake and California is going to float out into the Pacific and you guys will be broadcasting from the Hawaiian Islands or from a raft out there. And they laughed and they said, that's right, John, we're going to come back and we're going to come back stronger than ever. And they are back stronger than ever. I am so proud of them, their recovery. I'm so proud to be back and part of their, one of their hosts. But I am most pleased to be able to do this show that I've waited 6 or 7 weeks to do. And so right now, I want to introduce the two people that I could not have on 6 weeks ago. Chris Milligan, the founder and publisher of Trine Day, and the author of The Inheritance, Christopher Fulton. Chris Milligan and Christopher, I want to thank you so much for being here. I deeply, deeply appreciate it.
Thank you very much, John. I really appreciate it. You know, I and to Don and Doug, they've gone through a lot, and I really appreciate them coming up and giving us this platform, because one of the biggest statements that of this program is that I am publishing Chris Fulton's book. Okay, and I am publishing your book, your memoir. Okay.
Well, bless your heart for saying that, but listen, I want to focus on Christopher Fulton's book. So, Christopher, just say hello, and then I'm going to go to say hello, Christopher.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm just terrific and delighted that you're here. Love your book. And Christopher, Chris with a K, we're going to start with you. So, Christopher Fulton, I just want you to rest for a second. I'm going to focus on your publisher because Chris Milligan is the founder and president of Trine Day Publishing, which leading critics around the world say is the leading publishing house for alternative media and alternative news. They have over 100 titles, some of them bestsellers, and there's no question that Christopher Fulton's Inheritance is going to be one of them. So, Chris, with a K, I want you to tell us very briefly, if you can, a little bit about your childhood, where you come from, a little bit about your father, your family, what your dreams were, what you grew up doing, and then I want you to tell us how you happened to create Trine Day Publishing. What was the first book you published, and then how did you hear about Christopher Fulton and his amazing story? So you have the microphone.
Well, thank you, John. Basically, I'm a musician, and my father was a spook, okay? He got involved in intelligence at the age of 18 as an exchange student to China. And it's a very long story, but he was involved with COI, which was Donovan's first organization. Then he was in OSS. And then when he was in OSS, he got drafted. And OSS said, great, you're still going to work for us, but we're going to put you into the military. We're going to put you into military intelligence. And we're going to put you on MacArthur's staff because we do not trust MacArthur and his aide, Willoughby. Okay. Wow. And then he went through, you've heard of a guy by the name of Ed Lansdale.
Well, yes, absolutely.
My dad went into Manila way before the troops, sequestered the puppet government's library, helped the guerrillas set up their government, and helped them set up their diplomatic mission, and put a bunch of the collaborators in jail. When MacArthur finally got to Manila, he found a bunch of his friends in jail because he had been raised up in the Philippines, and he said, get rid of my dad. So they moved my dad to be head of research and analysis for the invasion of Japan, and they had to get somebody that was both in OSS and G2 at the same time at that time to replace him, and that person was Ed Lansdale.
Wow. Well, Chris, quickly, let me ask you, did your father tell you about this and inform you about what the world was really like, or did you discover this yourself when you were older?
Well, he gave me a couple of hints. And then the day before my 20th birthday, he had a talk with me with a professor from Vanderbilt, Dr. D.F. Fleming. And he took me in a little room and sat me down. And he said, the Vietnam War is about drugs. There's these secret societies behind it. Okay. Wow. I'm thinking he's talking about the mafia. And then he says, and communism is all a sham. These same secret societies are behind it all. It's all a big game.
And you were only 20 years old at the time?
The day before my 20th birthday, yes.
And you had to hide your reefer while he was talking to you, right? Okay. Well, now, what was your mother like?
My mother was a very good CIA wife. I would ask her questions, and she would say she didn't know anything. And finally, after my father had died, and going through his papers, she gave me some very good information because I was studying the subject I call CIA drugs. Because my dad, after the war, he went through a couple alphas, was at CIA at its beginning. His last overt job there was branch chief, head of all of East Asia Analysis Office.
Well, and Chris, hold on. You're doing all this research. Were you planning on being a journalist? Or were you interested in getting in the CIA yourself? Or what were your dreams as a 20-year-old?
I owned a record store. This was 1969. And I was putting on rock and roll dances with the Grateful Dead, John Mayall, Young Bloods, and people like that. So, and I was married and had a 6-month-old kid. So, and my dreams at that time were music,
rock and roll.
Yeah, well, blues.
You're still a very accomplished musician to this day.
If you want to make $1 million playing music, you start with two. You know.
Okay. Now, how old were you when you decided to start Trine Day? And what compelled you to do it? Because there were hundreds of publishing houses in those days.
Well, I was running an email list on the internet about CIA drugs, and I had a gentleman on there by name of Daniel Hopsicker, and he started decrying that his book had been with an agent for 2 years in New York, and nobody would publish it. And so after hearing that a while, I said, well, I've got a computer on my desk. They tell me I can make a book. Come on out and we'll make a book. So we made Barry and the Boys about Barry Seal. And
oh,
then,
my goodness. How wonderful.
And then I'd become friends with Professor Anthony Sutton, and he informed me that his book was going out of print. And I said, Anthony, that can't happen. It's never been hardcover. It's never been in libraries. And so I went out and borrowed $5,000 and started Trine Day, little knowing what I was getting myself into.
Well, you're going to have a monster hit with The Inheritance, and I'll tell you why, for a number of reasons, aside from I hear it might already be sold out.
Well, our first printing, you know, I mean, I don't have a lot of money, so I can't print, you know, I can't print a million books. I can print about 2,000 books. So we printed 2,000 books, and those have sold out, and we've got some more coming. I hope to sell, I'd like to sell 100,000 copies.
You could sell 100,000 of this book easily, and I'll tell you later on why I think it's going to make an immense film. And I tell you, this is an award-winning film critic. So, right now, I want you to tell me why and how you came across Christopher Fulton's story and why you decided to publish it.
I first heard about it from Robert Groden, and then actually, and Robert had given Christopher my phone number, and he called me up. And I says, well, if it doesn't say that Lee Harvey Oswald did it, we won't get any press, but, you know, I'd gladly publish it. And I told him that also that there's been a lot of changes happening, and self-publishing is a reality. He could do that. And I asked him if he had a manuscript, and he was working on it. And then about 2 years later, he called me up and said, well, you know, he talked to some people in Britain, and they wanted to publish it. If their American house would publish it, and they wouldn't do it. And then was at some other people, and they wouldn't publish it. And I read it, and I says, let's publish it. So,
well, kudos to you, because it's absolutely outstanding on a number of counts, believe me. So what I want you to do is I want you to set aside, because now we're going to talk to the author, Christopher Fulton. And during my conversation with him, because I have tons of questions to ask him, and I hope I get to them all in this hour, if I should forget something that you think is important and that Christopher isn't bringing up, please jump in, because it's the two of you for the remaining hour. So thank you so much, Christopher Fulton. Before we get to the content of your book, I want to get to the cover of your book. I have every single book ever published about the assassination, as you can well imagine. And as a critic, I have 1,000 other books. This is by far one of the most imaginative covers that I have ever seen on a book. Here you have the American flag, and the stripes are jail cell bars. And behind that is probably the ghost of Christopher Fulton, or it could be any American who's looking for the truth and is locked up by it. Kudos to you or whoever thought of it, because it is absolutely and totally brilliant.
Well, I appreciate that, John. It really, most of the credit goes to my wife in that regard, but it really is an American story. As I went through this process, it happened to me, but it really belongs to all of us. And I had to honor some of the people that were involved in when I was interrogated by the Justice Department and so forth, and what this was really all about. I had to come to terms.
I know that the co-author of your book is your wife, Michelle The Beatles wrote a song about her, and she certainly lived up to the title of that song. So you're saying that Michelle is largely responsible for this design. So the couple of questions that I have, and I can understand your compulsion to have to tell this story, because a lot of people, I don't want to talk about me, but a lot of people are saying, oh, you're a hero because you told Jim Garrison's story. No, Jim Garrison selected me to tell his story, and I just had to get it out of my system. There's nothing heroic about it. You just have to get it out of your system. So tell me a little bit. And you know what? You said you were locked up, but I must tell you, going to prison didn't turn your hair gray. It turned you blonde. I mean, you look absolutely terrific. But so was there, and then tell us a little bit now about your family, about Michelle, your children, how you met her, what you wanted to do as a youngster, where you were born and raised, what you actually ended up doing, which was, I believe, an architect and a builder, and then how you accidentally bumped into this story. So start at the beginning.
Well, that's a lot of questions, but I'll try to do my best. I was originally slated to go into the military, as well as my family had, to Annapolis and be a career officer, but I decided to take up where my dad had in commercial construction. So I took that and did very well at it. I was up in British Columbia, Canada, doing well with that. And subsequently, I never thought in a million years that I would have any access to the materials that came across myself and my friend Robert White. But it just so happened that he became very close with the President Kennedy's secretary, and she just happened to be the one that wound up with the bulk of material that Robert Kennedy had salvaged out of the White House that belonged to the Kennedy administration, and then subsequently his investigation into his brother's murder and the secret Oval Office recordings that President Kennedy kept after the falling out with the CIA. So that was done to keep everybody on record in point in the Oval Office and on the telephone and the briefing room so that he could keep everybody on point because he was being betrayed just about in every instance of keeping power and how he had different policy being instituted than what was coming out of the Pentagon and the agency at that time.
Christopher, excuse me. We're going to get to some of the specifics of that. You have, of course, a dedication at the top of your book. Who is the first person you dedicate the book to?
Well, the first person I believe was either to my mother or to Don Clark. I can't believe it. I don't remember which one it was.
It was to your mother. And I believe
my mother, yeah.
And why did you choose your mother? And did your mother, during the time you were having your travails, did she ever say to you, Christopher, please give all this up? Did she ever say that to you?
Well, my mother paid a great price for all of this, especially as a mother was concerned. She saw her son get demolished in this regard, and she knew that this was a heavy burden that we were taking on. But she was also subpoenaed in this process when I was taken and interrogated through the Justice Department, and the stress of it all caused a massive stroke, and she died. She died on that in regard to this.
Oh my God! Okay, now tell me, who is O.P. Wright?
O.P. Wright was the chief of security at Park and Hospital, and he was given two pieces of evidence that afternoon when President Kennedy came in at Parkland Hospital. One was a bullet that was found on a stretcher, which I believe is C-399. The other was a Cartier wristwatch that was worn by President Kennedy that wasn't supposed to be there, wasn't accounted for. So one piece of evidence he was given was used as a cornerstone of a lie to the American people, and the other one was used by Bobby Kennedy to determined his brother was killed in a coup, and it was a domestic coup, and he utilized part of that evidence and other evidence to the back channels of Russia to keep us out of World War III.
Well, I must tell you, that watch is the key to your movie. That watch is the key to your book. I want to know now what you were doing and how old you were when you did. Was this Robert White? A longtime friend of yours? Was he a business associate? So how old were you, and how did you bump into him, and how did this information bubble up?
Well, we'd been friends. He was only a few blocks from my lawyer's office in Catonsville, Maryland, and we both had a strong interest in U.S. history. So we had to cross paths and to become close. And then when he came into this large amount of material from Evelyn Lincoln, he contacted me to review it, to go through this so that we could possibly write a book. And then he would like to open up a museum to get this out to the American public. But it was a very large undertaking, a lot of material, and a lot of it non-reviewed, non-security reviewed, and would be classified. Found out later that this would be confiscated and classified. So I was in charge of trying to figure out what we could bring out and how we could bring it out, and what would be a concern for the Kennedy family and for the intelligence community in this.
What was the importance of the watch, and into whose possession was it first put?
The watch's importance was that there was numerous instances of why it was important. One, it was evidence that Lyndon Johnson had been complicit on the morning of. The watch was worn by President Kennedy because it was not one of the items withheld by Johnson's Secret Service that day. And on top of that, it wasn't accounted for in Parkland Hospital and was subsequently left there. Bobby Kennedy thought it was significant and had the head of the Protective Research Section, Robert Fowle, go to Washington, pick this up, bring it back for his investigation. And the watch, it was forensically tested to show a frontal shot, a frangible shot around that hit him in the front right temple.
How was that forensics able to determine that it was a frontal shot?
Well, the watch was only inches from the shot that exploded at his temple, and the watch had munitions particles in it, and also mercury particles enough to determine that it was military munitions that exploded in the front of his temple.
That is absolutely incredible. Now, the watch band may have had some of that residue, but wasn't the watch band replaced?
The watch band was removed by the Secret Service, and the watch was subsequently, Bobby Kennedy had given it to the care of Jackie to make sure that it would not be taken under the Johnson administration, the FBI, and then it was given to Evelyn Lincoln for her safekeeping after that.
How did it end up in your hands?
Evelyn Lincoln had passed it along to Robert White, wanted to make sure that these materials that she had did not go on to any under the guise of any federal agency or the NSA or the CIA, except that they knew that it'd be classified out of existence or destroyed. So she made sure that she found an individual she could trust, and these things would be transferred to him so that at some point in time, the American public could be notified about it.
How did it come into your possession?
Evelyn Lincoln had transferred it to Robert White, and of course I got it from Robert White. I got that and the Oval Office recordings that came into his possession from Evelyn Lincoln. We had signed contracts to do a book together, and I had made some acquisitions from him. Of course, the acquisitions that I made turned out to be some of the most significant pieces involved, and he had some significant pieces as well, which were taken later by the FBI and then classified.
Another major compliment to your book is the last fifth of the book seems to be a lot of documents. And I must tell you, reading the documents to me was as interesting as reading your personal story. And we're going to get into that also a little bit more. So what you have with the watch, you have forensic proof that there was a frontal shot that killed President Kennedy. Robert Kennedy had, Robert Kennedy had this. What do you think would have happened had he announced to the world that we have forensic evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald was not the shooter, somebody else was a shooter? Because when I spent my hours with Jim Garrison, one of the things that always bothered him was that Robert Kennedy was disrupting his investigation as much as was the Central Intelligence Agency, and he never could quite comprehend it. And he told one of his investigators, who happened to be comedian Mort Saul, he kept saying, "Will you tell your friend Bobby to go public? You might save the man's life. Otherwise, they're going to kill him too." He did not understand it. We're going to get to that in a little bit, which is just, to me, the 3 pages where Bobby Kennedy's private secret service man, I believe his name was Robert Bauk. Was that his name?
Robert Bauk.
Well, yeah.
Correct.
That is worth the price of the book alone, because for me, it answered all of Garrison's concerns. And we'll get to that in a minute. Now, I see also in the files that the Kennedy family is after you through lawyers to return the watch. And the watch was never returned. Why?
Well, I was ordered to turn the watch directly to the Kennedy family. Subsequently, there was agreements in place for a sale to go through Guernsey's, which had been the kickoff of that was done by Donald Trump. Donald Trump was kind of interested in getting this information out there, and had used his name and gotten the press involved. And of course, when the press got involved on all this, hell broke loose with the Justice Department and the Security Oversight Office. We were deemed to have national security information, and there was a lot of interested parties and a lot of interested things going around. There were subpoenas issued. Robert White had to capitulate to the Justice Department and sign a secret agreement with them and the Kennedy family and turn over materials to the FBI for classification. And the materials that I had were of subsequent weight that they decided they weren't going to let me testify in any way, and that and they were trying to shut this down and get this stuff back in and classified.
One of the files shows an agreement you have with Robert Wright to do this picture book, which probably would include the watch. And then later on, and good for you, there are letters saying that he wants all of this stuff back. I want to know when you were first, why they arrested you, why they imprisoned you, and still left the watch out there for auction. So let's start. Do you think that your friend White turned you in any way?
Well, Robert White was under, I didn't know this at the time, but Robert White had signed these agreements and was working in conjunction with the Justice Department to go forward, and that I was left kind of out on the outside of this. I was not a part of that inner circle deal. So I was left to float in the wind and see where these materials were going to go. And then obviously brought in late 98 under sealed warrants and indictments for a tax position earlier on in 1992. But the big reason why the Justice Department wanted me in is they wanted to interrogate me. They wanted to debrief me.
Why wouldn't they confiscate the watch? Because you have in there the bill of sale. Did somebody like Donald Trump come up to you and say, "Hey, I'd like to buy that watch"?
Well, the watch. I'm not. The watch went where it was supposed to go. I wasn't involved in that directly. I was involved in that through the Guernsey's auction house, but subsequently, they're the ones that made the final transfer, not me.
They sold the watch, but they. They sent you a check, didn't they?
They sent me a check.
For how much?
I believe it was $604,000.
Wow. Now, I could imagine you would have had to have sold it, but I can't imagine why they're going to lock you up and not confiscate the watch and hide the watch like they did a lot of the film footage at Dealey Plaza. And there's a wonderful picture there of Donald Trump in your book sitting in John Kennedy's rocker. And I wonder, did he buy that rocker? Did he talk ever at all about being president then?
I don't believe he bought the rocker, but I think he was very interested in these materials to go public, and he used his name in that regard to get the interest of the media in New York, and that was appreciated by Robert White, and they certainly were interested. CNN covered this, and Katie Couric and the Today Show had the material on her show, and they wanted to know a lot of information. They wanted to interview me, but at the time, I didn't want to give out that information to the public, and so I kept that to myself. There was things happening behind the scenes at that time, and I wasn't sure where the direction was going. So
I must tell you, it is not only is it compelling reading, it's more compelling listening to you, because I'm sure I don't have as good an ear as a lot of people. I'm sure a lot of people are sitting and listening to you and thinking, my goodness, that man's voice and cadence is exactly like John F. Kennedy, which is kind of eerie and kind of prophetic. So maybe you're speaking for John Kennedy from the grave, but it's extremely very, very compelling. When was it that they decided that they were going to lock you up? Did you have what you consider a fair trial? Where did they lock you up? How many places did they put you? What was it like, and how many years were you in prison? We know how it affected your mother. How did it affect your family and your and Michelle?
Well, and you know, the whole process is devastating. You go from a life that's relatively normal to something, to an existence that's surreal. I went through a process of extradition. The State Department and everybody else was involved in this, and then I got placed on a planes of federal aircraft in the United States and chained up at 10,000 feet for 10 minutes at a time, then brought back down to federal facilities on the ground. We'd do that all day long and then get a few hours sleep at night and do it all over again the next day. They transferred me over the country.
But Christopher, if they're not taking the watch, which is proof that it was a conspiracy, if they're not taking the watch, what other documentation did you have that they feared was going to be harmful to national security?
Well, they wanted the watch transferred. The watch was transferred. Obviously, that was their interest, is to get it transferred. It was transferred. It was out of my possession at the date that they arrested me. However, they were very concerned about the Oval Office recordings and were trying to force those into federal court for their non-destruction. But they're suppressed. Right, they had to be reviewed, national security viewed, and then I put through those processes. So I was being forced to. And held on that regard to get those recordings into the Fourth Circuit Federal Court.
And how long were you incarcerated in how many different prisons?
Well, I was in many different facilities to disorient me in the beginning of this process. And that, you know, I slept in one facility in New Jersey in a coffin, a military coffin, for about a month. I went to a Baltimore inner city jail. I slept on cobblestone there, and urine and feces for several period of time. And that, of course, that place is place they kept slaves to go through during that period of time, during the slavery days. And then I wound up at the Fourth Circuit Federal Court with a maximum security pretrial there, Charles County Detention Center, which is a facility where they have German shepherds and flak jackets and batons. Nobody comes into the maximum security area unless it's to do a strip search on you or to beat you into submission. It's a very maximum and extreme pretrial there for the Fourth Circuit, which is one of the most powerful circuits in the country.
Christopher, I'm sorry if I'm making you relive some of this horror, because it indeed was a horror. How many years did it last? What was the effect on your children and your wife? And what was the release like?
The children didn't exist yet, and I thought a lot about dying where I was. I'd watched people die, watched people taken with lethal injections that left that facility. I watched somebody that I knew very closely die, got beaten to death by the people running the facility. But the one of the things I thought a lot about is that, I didn't know if I was going to live through this or not, but if I did, I wanted to have children out of it. I wanted to have things in my life that mattered to. And that's one of the things that I gravitated towards very strongly when I was released. This whole process was about 8.5 years.
Wow, how horrible. Oh, you're out. Now you have the story that you have to tell, but now you have children. Are you going to put your children in jeopardy? Does Michelle say to you, instead of helping you write the book, does she say to you, honey, do you really want to tell this story? What were those conversations like?
There's no easy answers to these kind of questions, and it's no personally or professionally or anything else. You go to an attorney who's very well-versed, and you ask, you know, what happens? There's nobody that can tell you that. If there's an agenda that there's a problem, and you're going against the biggest lawyers in the world, the Justice Department, you don't know how this is going to be taken by the American public or anybody else. So, writing it was something that I had to come to terms with at a point in my life where I figured I'm either going to, you know, be on a deathbed and go and leave it and it's gone, no one's ever going to know about this slice of it, or I'm going to write it down so that somebody can at least have this understanding. And I seem to be the last, one of the last people alive to do this. I was hoping that some of this information would come out through the National Archives, which I peer through their investigation of the ARB, but some of the material that should be there is missing. We did a 30-day investigation, and it's gone. It's not there.
So a lot of the material that Robert Kennedy has that you had access to, the Kennedy family has access to, and they're certainly not doing anything about it, and probably for justifiable reason. But there are moments in the book. For example, you have that wonderful thing when you're talking about O.P. Wright and the fact that it got into the watch, got into the hands of Robert Kennedy, who kept the truth quiet to save us from a nuclear holocaust between the Soviet Union and America. Well documented and well written in the book. However, Jim Garrison always said the nuclear threat was an absolute hoax, which Lyndon Johnson used to force Earl Warren into heading up a commission that had to lie to the people.
Half of that's right, half that's not. It is a hoax in the effect that it was a staged situation that had been planted there from the beginning, but it isn't a hoax in the fact that the Russian government was very concerned about this assassination and was ready to have for an exchange with the American government at that time. It was a very serious situation.
There's no question that it was certainly serious, but Jim Garrison believed it would never happen, and he was right about that, thanks to John Kennedy and thanks to Robert Kennedy, thanks to the information in your book. But one of the things that I found quite thrilling in reading it was because the book is also written like a novel, as Dick Russell says in the introduction. If you didn't know it was the truth, you'd think, wow, this is an unbelievable story. And I must say, Christopher, I don't care if you're not even interested in the murder of John Kennedy. If you don't care anything about the deep state, this is one fantastic read. But the three pages that I kept reading over and over because of my friendship with Jim Garrison were the conversations you recreated between Robert Bauch and his best friend, Robert Kennedy. And that was the relationship between Robert Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald. And I knew that from Garrison, but I never put it in my film because it would cloud everything. So I left it out. Could you tell us about Robert Bauch, how he became so close to Robert Kennedy, why Robert trusted him, and what he says in these three unbelievable pages?
Well, Robert Kennedy and John F. Kennedy had problems with the rogue intelligence personnel going around their orders and circumventing things, and President Kennedy is very concerned that we might go to a new exchange over one of these mistakes, somebody circumventing his orders or acting in disregard to the to their agenda. So from what I understand, Lee Harvey Oswald was somebody that they were looking at, and they looked at other people as well, somebody that they could keep tabs on directly to give them straight information on what was happening on the inside of many different factions. And Lee Harvey Oswald was an informant through the FBI, and that coded number that he utilized was recognized by Robert Kennedy. So information was getting back through the Justice Department to him.
But did Robert Kennedy have any personal contact with Lee Harvey Oswald?
As far as a one-on-one, I did not see any material that was a one-on-one material. What I saw had to do with coded information and things coming back to them to avoid his brother being compromised or put into a position to force his hand into Cuba.
Did you have personal conversations with Robert Bauch?
I did, yes.
Did he? Because the recreations of those conversations in the book are unbelievably compelling. One gets the impression that Robert Kennedy, according to Garrison, was the one leader of the plot to assassinate Fidel Castro. And one of the people employed to help facilitate this assassination was Lee Harvey Oswald. And that is also the impression that I get from those three pages where you recreate those conversations. Am I right about that?
Lee Harvey Oswald was being utilized for purpose. A lot of the information that you see in his FBI files was planted. It was planted for purpose to get him close to Castro.
And do you think that's really why he was trying to get into Castro or into Cuba? Or do you think that he was really trying to get into Cuba so the CIA could more cleverly set him up as the patsy?
I mean, we'll never know how history could have unfolded if things had changed direction. But all I can speak intelligently about is the information that we reviewed that came out of from Robert Kennedy in the White House. That's all I can talk about.
Well, you have some absolutely startling, startling stuff in this book. And I'll tell you one of the things that, I mean, I shouldn't be thinking about a movie, but years ago when I was a kid, I saw this great film based on a Henry short story about an overcoat. And the movie follows the overcoat through its lifespan till it frays and tells the story of all the owners of that overcoat. Wonderful movie, wonderful short story. And I see that for your film. Have you had any film offers yet?
There's been nothing directed to me with any affirmative at this point, no.
Well, it would make an unbelievable movie. I don't think anyone in America has the courage to make it anymore, but maybe somebody in Europe or elsewhere has, because it is an incredible book, an unbelievable story. And right now I would like to, because I don't want to feel like I'm beating up on you in this, because so you can obviously see I'm immensely impressed by you and the book. And so I'm going to introduce Joe Satilli, who probably has a number of questions to ask you. So, but I will ask you, with all this in your head now, all of this in your book, and a lot of the stuff in your head that is unsaid, do you think there will ever be open disclosure about the government's murder, in particular the CIA's murder of President John F. Kennedy?
Well, I'd like to think there would be. I mean, the Trudeau, who I've met, both his father and his son, earlier when I was young, he made an announcement to the Canadian government saying that they had targeted individuals improperly and was sorry for this, and the government was making reparations in that regard, even in abolishing criminal records that were involved in this kind of prejudice. And I think that sets a pretty nice precedent that I'm not sure that the United States government wants to do any of this or wants to concede any of this, but I think at sometime eventually we'll have to take some responsibility and discuss about this openly.
Do you think Donald Trump will ever force the CIA to release some of the files? He talked about it months and months ago, but then evidently he was talked out of it, saying more business about national security. After a 55-year-old murder, Christopher, what possibly could affect national security about talking about this?
It's not just the murder of one man in 55 years ago. This goes farther and farther down the road even till today, and we have strong repercussions and shockwaves that have happened because of this, and foreign policy, domestic policy, and individuals that have gained power and great wealth and so forth and so on. So I think to protect those individuals, IRS records are protected, grand jury information is protected, and of course the Bobby Kennedy's information has been well protected. Even now, when we had raw data coming out, it was harped on and then taken and classified. So I think that they're very very concerned about all of this to this present day, and that's obvious. But I hope there can come a time when this can be transparent.
Where are you and Michelle and your children living now? How many children do you have, and what are their
names? I have two children. We live in California at the present time, and my son is named Bo, I don't really want to bring my children into it too much. We can keep them out.
I can well understand that. But I imagine they are probably around 8 to 10 years of age, close to that.
They're actually quite young. My son, who I delivered myself, is one year old. My daughter is.
Where did you do that? Where did you deliver your son?
Well, again, I didn't choose that. It was something you say, well, here it comes. You step up or you don't. And that's, of course, been a lot of my life.
Gracious. That's wonderful. Joe, are you there?
I'm here.
Please step in and talk to both Chris Milligan and Christopher.
I'm going straight to Mr. Milligan because he's sitting there as a spectator. And I have he mentioned Daniel Hopsicker. And if people are not familiar with that, Daniel Hopsicker of Mad Cow Productions, he wrote a book called Welcome to Terrorland. And Daniel Hopsicker is the guy who rooted around in Mohammed Atta's life and found a lot of cocaine and strippers and a lot of very interesting things going on with Mohammed Atta. And I just want to ask Mr. Milligan, you know, we're in a really odd place with what used to be called conspiracy theories. Now I guess we're calling it alternative media or whatnot. As somebody who publishes, what do you see after the effect of Roger Stone and Alex Jones and sort of the distortive effect of the idea of conspiracy theories in popular culture over the last 5 years, 3 to 5 years, what are the challenges in publishing these kinds of alternative views of history right now?
Getting them talked about in the mainstream. As long as they're just in the shadows, they create all kinds of, you know, false stories too. Okay. So the biggest challenge is getting it out there. And again, like I said at the beginning, it's a statement of our time when John Barber's book, Christopher Fulton's book, Dan Hopsicker's books have to come out, have to be printed by a hippie out in Oregon.
Well, no comment.
Endorsement more than 100 times.
No comment.
That's
you know,
funny.
So
you don't
have a
thought on that?
Go ahead.
Fulton?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you have a thought on that, on where? See, it seems to me, somebody spent a lot of time on this, and this is going back to particularly the end of the 70s, the beginning of the 80s, the October surprise, the Reagan administration, which was full of all kinds of covert fun and games that we are still dealing with today. One of the great untold scandals, the BCCI scandal, which involved the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, Pakistan, the arming of Al-Qaeda. Nobody knows about BCCI. Nobody understands that and how it intersected with drug trade and Afghanistan. And you know, today I hear a lot of stuff about heroin coming across the border. Well, isn't it interesting that heroin continues to be a cash crop in Afghanistan, where the United States is ostensibly in control of particularly the northern part where the heroin is grown? Is there a particular challenge now to get stories out about things like the Kennedy assassination in light of all of the distortive effects of conspiracy theories in popular culture?
Yes. There's again, I'm having to publish these books. Okay, these books should be coming out from New York. Okay, but you know, I have to publish them because nobody else will. Nobody else does.
Are you approached? Do you ever find yourself approached by somebody who is floating an idea for a book, and you find the idea suspect, and you feel like maybe it's a disinformation attempt?
Oh yeah. I did a book by Doug Caddy. I mean, I love Doug Caddy. He's a very, very good guy. Okay, but if you read my publisher's forward in there, I say, hey, you know, I don't know why these guys are sending us these places. And I went and talked to Jim Hogan and sent him a copy of it beforehand and say, hey, what do you think? And he says, well, you know, you should publish it. It's a very important book, but you should tell people that you think there's something hinky going on. Because, you know, one thing I did after my dad talked to me and I started looking into him, I took on conspiracy theory as an intellectual discipline.
Right.
And one thing that I found out is that a conspiracy theory doesn't have to be true to be effective. Okay.
You're right. Christopher, I have two quick questions for you. Before you came across all of this information, What were your thoughts about the John Kennedy assassination? Did you have any interest in it? And what were your thoughts about America in general?
Well, to answer the first question, did I have any interest in the Kennedy assassination? Not really. My father worked for a small task force for President Kennedy. My mother had met Robert Kennedy several times on the shuttle between New York and Washington. But I didn't know much about it. I don't know the community that's involved in this or the people that have been diligently working trying to help resolve these issues for our country. I was not involved in any of that. But I was—I grew up pretty red, white, and blue, outside of the district, and I believe strongly in our country and our nation, and we were, the greatest nation on earth. And as I went through these materials and was absorbing this information, it broke my heart. I was listening to the President of the United States speak to me one-on-one in recordings. I was the first person to listen to those. Since Bobby Kennedy had been reviewing them. And here's a young president who cared about every individual, every American citizen, the democratic process. Were we going to continue in the world being peaceful? Were we going to continue in a world and be able to avoid this nuke fire, nuke holocaust, this agenda that were being pushed? He pretty much dedicated himself and his life and in a full agreement with his wife and an understanding that this was the most important thing in the world to him. And if he lost his life in this regard, that was going to be the way it was. I read Jackie's wills in 62 and 63. They were well aware of an assassination possibility even then. This is not something fresh to them that came out of nowhere. And they were taking on that responsibility with all seriousness to change the direction of the United States for the better, for the peaceful resolve of this for the world. In 9 days of President Kennedy's assassination, the last thing he wrote above Air Force One, the last words he wrote were government reform. We are going forward. That was a coded message to be included at the trademark speech for Khrushchev to understand that in 9 days, they were going to resolve these issues with Castro in Cuba. That the CIA was going to be dismantled. The CIA personnel and these staged world events were going to stop. And if Kennedy had lived... we would have had a very different world than we're looking at now. And I feel very sad in my heart about all of that.
Amen.
Amen.
Two minutes left.
Okay, we have 2 minutes left. I'm going to ask Christopher one last question. In looking at all of this material, Christopher, when was it or what was it that you read or heard or saw that said to you, my God, the government really murdered John Kennedy? And the media is covering it up. When did that moment hit you?
Well, there were several moments of that, and like I say, the whole part of this American piece of history, it's a very sad story that the American public knows very little about. That they don't know that President Kennedy was advised not to go to Dallas, that he'd be shot at Dallas. But it was called off, supposedly, and that he went ahead anyway, and that, of course, it was turned back on. But he was desperately trying to hold on to the reins of power and change the way this country was going to resolve the issues of becoming a world superpower with these weapons of mass destruction that were going on and on. And he laid down his life, and his brother did, too. The last thing Robert Kennedy said when he was shot is everybody, I believe it was something to the effect, is everybody else okay? Cared about people. He cared about our lives and our children and your children and my children, where we were going and the future of this country and the world. And these weren't just words coming out of the Kennedy's mouth. These were things that meant everything to them, and they laid their lives down for it. And that's why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because there's been a lot of good Americans killed over this issue to silence this. And I'm one of the last people left in this narrative to say something about it. And I'm telling you, the government doesn't care what you know, but when you have something that can go into court and change the narrative, they put you in prison and they kill you.
Well, I must tell you, Christopher, I thank you. And before we even started this interview, I had a dozen and a half emails from people saying they absolutely loved the book and were looking forward to you again tonight. I'm glad you mentioned the fact that Kennedy was warned about not going to Dallas, because we're on the verge of releasing Jim Garrison's files that he sent to the House Select Committee that they do not want released. CIA doesn't care about releasing their files because there's no blueprint on how we killed the president. But they don't want Garrison's files released. But we're going to release them. And one of the things that was in the first file came from a Texas representative. He wrote directly to Robert Kennedy, begging him not to let his brother come to Dallas because he was going to be killed. I cannot thank you enough. I'm going to hold this book up again as the last. You must read this book. Even if you care not a whit about the assassination of John Kennedy, it is an unbelievable human story about a real American.
Good time.
Thank you so much, Chris and Christopher, and bless you.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, Joe.
Take care.
Good night.
God bless. Amen.
All right.
Well,
I wanted to say we're off, but I thought your question was very, very good. I think that's a very important question to ask because in this transient period, we have to be asking ourselves.
I apologize. I hate to interject. I just do have to run because I got 2 minutes to get the next show on.
Well, hey, you know what? We should come back and have a seminar on this question about conspiracy theories because
I think it's very important.
I'll just hang up, but you all should still be connected, okay?
Oh, okay. Let me just...
I'm just going to hang up, but you all should still stay connected. Okay.
Thank you. Joe?
Yeah.